Hello there, and welcome to Pink Milk, where we serve Star Wars queerly. I'm your host, Brian, and we are about to get on the inside. Are you with me? Let's go!
I love you.
I know you. Can I buy you a drink?
We are going deep inside the Lucasfilm walls, y'all. We're going deep in a way that we never do here on Pink Milk. So I'm very, very excited for y'all to listen to this upcoming conversation that was so wonderful and it lasted so long that it's not one, but two parts. So here is part one. You will get to hear part two of my conversation with our friend, Jake Niemeyer, who has worked on The Bad Batch, Tales of the Jedi, and a whole host of other non-Star Wars things. And he's a big Star Wars fan himself. So to hear some perspective as a fan, as a professional in and out of Star Wars, I think we're in some, for some really, really good conversation. This week, it's really about working in Lucasfilm and the idea of Star Wars and how to write for Star Wars and what it means to be in Star Wars and Disney before and after the acquisition, all of those things. Next week, we're going to talk about some queer stuff, being queer in the industry, being queer in Lucasfilm, being gay out in the world. That's next week, though. Right now, get ready for my talk, our talk. Let's hang with Jake. Let's go. Drink up. Well, hello there, everyone, and welcome back, and welcome our friend Jake. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing super duper. Before we get going, a couple questions for you, my friend. How do you identify?
As gay. Very nice. I go by he, him pronouns.
I love it. I love it. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get going on this big old conversation?
Sure. I'm an assistant editor, so I've worked on a handful of TV shows now. Before that, I was doing lots of commercials and branded content and all those internet videos of all sorts. I worked on some Disney Parks videos, which were fun, where they would take the Disney Channel stars to like Disney World and have like their best day ever. And cheesy things like that. And immediately before that, I worked on videos for Andrew Christian, which was a bit of a
cultural shift.
Yeah. And then like Motor Trend videos and like all sorts of just random things. And then eventually got on Star Wars. The Bad Batch and Tales of the Jedi, which was a lot of fun. And then after that, I did a VFX AE job for Invasion. I was filling in for someone who got promoted to another show. And then got on The Watcher, which was on Netflix from Ryan Murphy Productions. And then Shadow and Bone Season 2, which was a lot of fun. And now I'm just finishing up Upload for Amazon Prime. It's with Robbie and Mel. It's from Greg Daniels, who made The Office and Parks and Rec.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Awesome. So
about a guy who dies and goes to a digital afterlife.
Yep.
Lots of silly shenanigans and tale.
That's awesome. That's we are just now kind of getting into Prime for the first time ever. So it's a fun gig. I like that. I like that concept too. Star Wars. That's what most people are here for on old Pink Milk. Have you always been a Star Wars fan?
Oh yeah. From, I think it was like first time I saw a Star Wars movie, I had to be, I don't know, like two or three. And you know, it was back in the early 90s. It was probably actually right around the 10th anniversary of Return of the Jedi, because that was what was playing on TV, you know, and back then, like, we only had a handful of channels. And so my mom would, like, cycle through the channels and stuff. And I don't know why as a child, but a lot of things, like, for kids, I found patronizing and didn't like. So when she settled on this teddy bear show, I was like, I don't want to watch this. And so we cycled through again. And I think it was, like, the Emperor electrocuting Luke. And I was like, ooh, let's watch this. And, you know, she was trying to convince me, maybe we shouldn't. You just said you didn't want to watch this and, you know, all that stuff. But so, yeah, that was my introduction to Star Wars.
I love that. First, let's hope that you think Ewoks are more than teddy bears now, because Ewoks are amazing. I think I've shared this story before on the podcast, but in case you're new here, the lightning scene with the Emperor got me in a lot of trouble when I was younger. Oh. I did not go to church, didn't want to for the most part when I was younger. However, I was probably fourth grade, somewhere in there. So I was 10, 11. I decided to try to go to Sunday school with a friend of mine, and they were playing clips of Return of the Jedi talking about evil or something. I'm sure it was like something really innocent and probably really good for children to hear, right? But all I heard was the church saying that Star Wars was bad. And so I raised my hand and I told them that how wrong they were, and that the Emperor was actually a bad guy, and that Luke Skywalker's a hero and Star Wars was really good, and that God was basically the Force and all of those things, and they should really rewatch the movies. And then I was politely asked to sit outside until the Sunday school. I look back now as an adult, I'm like, that poor mother of the friend who had to go. I have to say, I love that, because I think I was the same way. As a kid, I liked the bigger questions, and that's something that Star Wars still to this day resonates with me. And as a father now with a child, you know, who's a super fan at 9 going on 10, and to hear him understand all of those bigger concepts, especially as he's gotten older, you know, he'll have a conversation about clones at 4. And now that he's almost 10, the conversation is very different. And, I think it's a part that is overlooked a lot, at least on online discourse with Star Wars.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think one of the, you know, because I started on Bad Batch in season 1, and I remember one of the controversies when it finally came out, which was so long after we had like made it and stuff. And like, we were always trying to be cognizant, and everyone in every department, you know, I can really only speak for editorial, which was like, we had 2 episodic editors, me and another assistant editor, and then an associate editor who kind of helped with the finishing process of the episodes. And it's so interesting being on that side of it, because you have to let some of your fandom stuff aside, but you also have to be aware of like what fan expectations are. But I remember when it finally came out, everyone was so upset about the Kanan stuff, the revised origin, and of how it was like different from the comic in different ways. And, you know, the big thing for when you are a creative and you are in that space, it's more about what is telling your current story best, more so than what perfectly lines up to another story. So for the Bad Batch, it was important to give the audiences a character they already cared about to help them start caring about these characters.
Yep.
You know, because in the original plan for Clone Wars, there would have been another Bad Batch serial that would have had like Yoda and been on Kashyyyk. It actually was kind of modified to be a season 2 episode of the Bad Batch. And so that would have been like during the Clone Wars and had a lot more things going on and been like 3 or 4 episodes. But you would have had more time to kind of grow with these characters before transitioning into their own show. So it was important to have some of these anchor characters to help solidify their place in the galaxy. But yeah, it's, and then when you like step back and stop trying to treat it like a history and start treating it like a story, it's like both of these origins work in parallel. Mm-hmm. Like everything for Kanan's story after this origin moment, either version of events works perfectly for what you see later. It's not so much just about like, oh, they were, the clone troopers were in red versus green and it was daytime versus nighttime. It's like, those things don't really matter. And like there are bigger story changes, don't get me wrong, but they both can kind of live and coexist, and it can be from a subjective point of view rather than an objective point of view.
Yep. You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because I think that opening of The Bad Batch was so incredibly important because of everything you said. We already had those who had come before already had a lot of attachment to Kanan specifically. So it was a very rewarding experience to see that moment for Kanan of not trusting the clones. Yes, it was implied when we get to see him and Rex in Rebels, but to see it was something different. But for someone who was just coming in, he was just a youngling, so of course it's traumatic and all of those things. And so it really, really works very, very well. And I love what you said about like the story and certain moments and beats need to hit that specific story. And I keep going, you know, this is probably easy for me to say because I'm not the biggest canon junkie. Like, I don't really care that much for the most part. Because for me, I always go back to a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah.
And that already implies that this is a fairy tale. It implies that it's a story that has been passed down, and stories oftentimes when they are passed down change. Different religions can pick up a similar story and tell the same story of Jesus Christ in a little bit of a different way.
And think about the flood narrative. Like, if you want to go to like almost every religion has a flood narrative, and the ways in which they are different are fascinating. But yeah, and that was honestly a big part of what George wanted. Like in the same way that he very deliberately, you know, and this kind of faded away as the show continued, but he very deliberately wanted Clone Wars to be out of order and very shuffled, because he was like, it's not about start and finish. It's about just individual stories and just kind of picking up in the middle of things. And then that's like that, all of that mentality really cemented in Dave and a lot of the other storytellers they fostered in it, of where it's like, don't worry too much about how it connects. Of course it all connects in some way or another. And, you know, Marvel has definitely created different expectations on all that front. Which it's also been fascinating just to, I'm so curious what people will say about the past 10 years or so of filmmaking and television. Like once it's, you know, able to step back and kind of look at of like a bigger cause and effect of how this has been a very, very strange decade or so of between how we consume media, what media is at the forefront, what genres just aren't being made to the same degree anymore. And a lot more has changed than I think anyone can comprehend, because we all lived through it so slowly.
1,000%. And I think actually the MCU's effect on everything is fascinating to me as well, because like Star Wars has always done the same thing that they are currently doing, except for now it's being spoken to as this cinematic universe and interconnectivity, which, you know, I loved that for Marvel. It was great at the time. It was cool. But the fact that it was needed to be everywhere was really frustrating. And I'm curious what's going on now, because at least at the time that we're making this, like the last few MCU movies have not been as financially successful as they had in the past. Again, I'm not on like MCU Twitter, but I always felt like MCU was always praised no matter what. And like Star Wars, like, you know, blinked wrong and it was all over and it was awful. That was like my perception, whether or not it's true or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors to that. Like every 10, 15 years or so, there's a genre boom, and then it naturally subsides. Mm-hmm. So I would say superheroes is the current boom that is subsiding. Before that, there was a fantasy boom in the 2000s, you know, between Pirates of the Caribbean. You had some of the early comic book movies. You had Harry Potter. You had Narnia. You had all of these big franchises trying to do fantasy. And then before that, in the 90s, you had all the disaster movies. And then in the 80s, you had the slashers. And then you also had the teen coming of age movie boom, which kind of lasted through the 90s. In the 70s, you had the eco horror. And you had from the late 70s to early 80s, you had that sci-fi boom. And then in the 60s, you had some of the last big musicals. You had all these character pieces that were trying to challenge the Hays Code without breaking it. And the, you know, and you can just go back decade by decade. You know, the 40s had the film noir trend, and in the 50s overseas, you had the different trying to basically the inverse of It's a Wonderful Life. You know, you had Bicycle Thieves and French New Wave and all of that stuff coming in. So it's like, there's, I think, the big difference to now is we didn't used to attach cultural identity to film genres or franchises in the same way we do now. We didn't used to do that in the past. Yes, there were fans of different things, but that wasn't the like monoculture, so to speak.
Yeah,
you know, you had Star Wars fans and you had Star Trek fans. And you had a lot more fandoms when you get into novels and things like that. But like, it wasn't to the same degree where people would be insulted as Westerns started dying out in the 50s. Like, people weren't like, but how dare you say Westerns aren't what's going on anymore? Like, and some people do make Westerns their entire personality. Don't get me wrong. Like, that country music, like, there is a culture around that. But it's okay for things to ebb and flow. And I think with Marvel, kind of similar to what Star Wars had to do after the success of Mandalorian in parallel with the less than success of Rise of Skywalker, just got to readjust, reformat the budgets, and find a way to keep it going, but realize you are going to be catering more to a specific audience rather than all audiences. You're not going to be the everything that you used to be.
I love everything that's going on in Star Wars. You know, some things have hit better than others for me. Yeah. And that's fine because that's everybody. And that was an adjustment for a lot of people when George sold Star Wars, you know, because we knew we were going to get a lot more of it in a larger form. I mean, there's always been a ton of Star Wars with books and comics, but in like mainstream, we were going to get a lot more of it than we had ever had. Yeah. And therefore, like, I knew I was going to have to kind of prepare myself to possibly not like a Star Wars as much as another. And that was honestly, like, I care about this probably too much. And that was very hard on me, but
same,
you know, I made it through and it's fine.
I started on Bad Batch right after being less than thrilled with Rise of Skywalker, which was very awkward. And when I say that, I wasn't necessarily, a lot of my coworkers had more harsh opinions than I had, which was also fascinating because there's, you know, anytime you see someone online, they're like, oh, you know, you work there, so of course you love it all. And it's like, that's not how reality works. We're still human beings. We're not robots. We haven't been replaced by AI yet. you know, that writer's strike and who knows who may follow. It's interesting to have to, you know, grapple with all of it and you know, accept the ones you don't like. You know, as far as like, I remember, I don't know, like in a rewatch of the prequels, like maybe 10 years ago, like whenever, and it wasn't 10 years ago, it was a little less than that. It was when the Machete Order first became popular, yep. like when that blew up. I remember like going through and really watching it all and being like, it's interesting that I think Phantom Menace is a much better film than Attack of the Clones, mm-hmm. but Attack of the Clones is more relevant to the overarching story. And having to kind of like, well, so which is better or which is more important, and kind of wrestling with that in a different way. And then, you know, I think with time, you can accept the things that you don't like. Yep. Like there are, you know, and then have a more nuanced opinion about some of these things. It's like, yep. I think the storytelling in Rise of Skywalker is not the strongest, and hearing the writers talk about it of like, you know, they went in with, we want to create visual moments that really are exciting for us. And that, you know, if this is our last chance to work on Star Wars, what do we want to see? And then we'll worry about stringing it together later. It's like, that's not how I'd approach a screenplay, but to their credit, it has some of the most stunning visuals I've ever seen.
Yep.
You know, I think Exegol in particular is something that's just beautifully realized. The ice asteroid planet thing at the very beginning, gorgeous. And so there's a lot of things that you can appreciate, even if you don't like where they came from or some of the yep. other things that come with it.
Yep.
You know, and I would say the same to people who hate The Last Jedi and, you know, or whichever one.
Yep.
You know, and, but yeah, and I think what was also interesting working there is a lot of people not only have – the people who've been there for a while have much harsher opinions than you'd ever expect. Including on the things that they work on, because it's like they've been in these trenches for a long time, you know. They care about what they work on, you know. One of the people I worked with had been – for like 20 years, like, he started on Attack of the Clones. He's actually in Attack of the Clones as like one of the extra Jedi in the Geonosis sequence.
Love it.
And then like he worked on the Clone Wars cartoon. He worked at ILM. Like I know he worked on, one of the James Bond movies and, you know, he came back for Rebels and Bad Batch and Resistance. And so much of these teams have been one consistent team for a very long time. And it's like one person will switch out every now and again. And that's also been a fascinating thing about the Disney crossover is so much less of it was, you know, this changeover. Like, yes, new people came in and some new things were done differently. But a lot of the people that were there before at Lucasfilm and at ILM are still there. Mm-hmm. And their job titles might have a different name to them now, or they might be working in live action instead of animation. Like there are, but the continuity of people is really there. When you're, especially in the animation department, a lot of them are like, yeah, we didn't really notice too much of a changeover. I think the biggest changes were with the Bad Robot stuff, because that was another studio or yep. production company kind of coming in and having their own way of doing things. And not to say there was conflict or anything, but it did change the dynamic a little bit to where, you know, whereas like Rebels was still all internal, but like under Disney, yep. Resistance had to kind of work with Bad Robot a little bit more and kind of couldn't explore certain things because they didn't know where the movies were going to go.
Yep.
Or, you know, things like that.
Yep. But. Yeah, there's I remember last year at Star Wars Celebration listening to Matt Wood, and there's some interesting things going on because one, I can't believe he said it on a big stage, and maybe it wasn't a massive bomb, but like he had made a comment during the Attack of the Clones 20th anniversary that George Lucas hired people and really trusted them. And if George didn't necessarily always understand something, he would basically, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, I could be getting it a little wrong, but the main gist of it was, do you think it'll work? And if they said yes, he's like, then I trust you and go. And Matt Wood had mentioned, you know, I miss those days of that kind of connection and just going, and I didn't have to go through 50 people to get a thing done. And there is something that, again, and I have said this for a long time, and I could be completely wrong, and I'm sure I am wrong because I don't know anything, but when I listen to interviews or I watch certain stories or I watch things, there is something, and it's the thing I miss the most about George. And it's also helped me accept the things that I don't like as much. But George Lucas, to me, I miss the middle finger that he put up at people. I miss the middle finger of, this is my creative story. I love that so many other people love it, but I'm going to do what I want to do because I'm an artist and I work with other artists, and we are here to do what we want to do. I don't care what mainstream audiences want. I don't care what the studios are telling me to do. This is mine. And again, like you mentioned, Attack of the Clones, it is right up there with Return of the Jedi. It is like my favorite Star Wars movie. Look, on the surface, is it a perfect film? I don't know. But I can tell you it is a perfect Star Wars movie, just like Return of the Jedi is a perfect Star Wars movie. I for me, they're like all over the board. I am here for George Lucas's writing. I love that kind of dialogue because I don't need it to compare to anything else. It's just Star Wars. And that was something like with Andor that was so hard for me because, look, Andor's like perfection. It is so good. But like, I kind of miss some of that clunky writing. I'm not going to lie. Even though I know objectively speaking, this is crafted so much more beautifully. But I was like, kind of looking forward to Mandalorian.
Well, and it's, I think there's a lot more than just that because there, the tough thing is like, yes, I think George would trust people and let people go off in different directions. And I think some of those decisions have been more, you know, give and take different ways at different times. Mm-hmm. Like at first with like Jar Jar Binks, they had a like 90% prosthetic version that would have like completely been a different trajectory for the prequels and things like that. Just based in like how that was realized. And it was like, it was the, you know, people working at ILM being like, well, let's push this. If we do this all digital character, that'll be something new. And like, people don't understand how much of the industry has changed at George's whims, and particularly with the prequels. Mm-hmm. Like, editing digitally instead of like cutting film, you know, like using Avid and things like that. And like, our entire VFX post pipeline is based on what they did with the prequels. For the entire industry, like everyone now does what was started there. And while people were very, very angry about Jar Jar, that is what paved the way for things like Gollum, for, you know, these movies that are completely CGI characters, like Transformers, like, you know, I'm blanking on different other examples, but like
Thanos, so all sorts things. Of people.
Yeah. Thanos, like so many Marvel characters and so many, like even the way that we do any sort of motion capture for video games and for like certain types of, not all 3D animation, but a lot of 3D animation is also part of that pipeline. And, you know, we wouldn't have that unless it was, you know, Jar Jar and that silliness.
Yep.
And, you know, but I think at the same time though, it's like with under Disney, I think there are a lot of people who want to do that and who are trying to do that. But then there are just so many people who work on a film to the point to where it's not, you do need one person steering the ship. And sometimes they're going to make decisions that not everyone likes. And, you know, like Solo is an easy example. Lord and Miller are super talented writer directors, but they come from a more improvisational background. Yep. You know, they, from all the reports, I don't have much insider info. I've heard a couple of stories, but like from all the reports I've heard, it's much more that they were looking to do something much sillier and much, you know, on the spectrum between, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy and Spaceballs, they were probably a little closer to Spaceballs than they were the original trilogy. And there were struggles on set. You know, that's where, I don't know if anyone remembers all the reports of Alden needing acting lessons. Yep. And stuff. And it's not because he was a bad actor. It was because he was on set and suddenly he was told he can't do any of the lines that he's memorized. And there was a lot of that kind of conflict, and it was really upsetting the producers and co-writers of the film. And that's when they brought in, you know, the head of the studio to say, like, hey, there's a major conflict going on over here of where the writers are wanting one thing, the director is wanting a very different thing. And it's creating a sense where a lot of people under that don't know which direction to go. And yep. That's what hurt the movie. And while, you know, I wouldn't have said that Ron Howard would be my favorite choice to yep. go in, he was able to get rid of the confusion and steer that ship. And yep. on time, you know, them losing those extra 6 months to be able to have a Christmas release instead of being released. What was it? It was like the week between Deadpool 2 and mm-hmm. Infinity War. Mm-hmm. How is that movie going to ever make money?
Yeah.
Reshooting yep. 80% of the movie and then being released right then. Like, it was in some ways set up to fail. And I don't think by anyone's intention, but it just, things happen.
That's another one cracks me up. The conversations around that movie, it is my favorite Disney era film. Like, really? I see everything, right? Like, I mean, you can't not, but again, to me, it is such a perfect Star Wars movie. It is just so Star Wars. Thank God it was not what it looked like it was going to shape up to be. Because look, I'm here for a spoof movie. That's fine. But not a Star Wars spoof movie. Don't make fun of yourself. You know, like.
Well, even. But that's also kind of what Detours was. And that's.
Nope.
I think part of where that got shelved was they were realizing, like, while there are funny jokes, and I think maybe now, especially because so much time has passed now, it's like. I've been told a lot of the relevancy of some of the jokes would just kind of fall flat now. Yeah. I would love for it to get released under that like Star mm-hmm. Wars vintage label, or mm-hmm. if they were to do Star Wars Legends on Disney Plus or something. But, you know, they were just like the tone of George's world and humor and the tone of, you know, the robot chicken guys. It just doesn't fully connect.
Yep.
And that's okay. And I think there's room for things to be more than just kind of what it was, you know, in the same conversation of like Andor being very different
yep.
to everything that's come before. And it's like, I think I'm always open to all of those different avenues. I think sometimes what's hard is when, you know, the people making these things aren't afforded all of the resources to put that best foot forward. And, yep. you know, there are times where things are either rushed or, you know, just not quite given the budget that's needed, or, you know, there are just so many moving pieces, especially with Star Wars, to where some of these projects that are like, you really will see a lot that's great there. And then just a few things that you're like, that doesn't quite work.
Yep.
Or, you know, maybe a chase scene here or there was like really slow and you're questioning how it's a chase scene, but like you got to make things work the best you can with what you got. And
we're not remotely talking about it's a small world adventure in the middle of a Book of Boba Fett series, are we?
We could say we were mentioning that, but we could just as easily say we were talking about Leia running away from bounty hunters. I think both of those chase sequences are, they could have used a little bit tighter of an edit maybe. Mm-hmm. But I also don't know that they had the coverage and the, yep. the time on set to film what was necessary, or even time in post to yep. cut it down to where it needed to be. You know, there's just so many factors with how sped up production became for Disney Plus. And also the fact that, you know, it would be a lie to say that streaming isn't profitable, but streaming has plateaued in their profits. So when you have a big publicly owned company, you know, consistent profits are seen as loss, even though you're making the same amount of money every year, but that's viewed as loss because it's not growth. And that's been a big struggle across the industry. You know, I think that's part of why studios haven't been eager to meet writers' demands and, you know, as other strikes may happen as well, because they have so much lead time right now and they were already looking at ways to cut spending across the board. You know, between if you want to look at the Warner Brothers shelving things permanently and forever for tax write-offs, if you want to look at cancellations, if you want to, you know, there's so many things where it's just, there's going to be a big contraction in the amount of things getting made for all of these platforms and the amount of money being spent on them, because there is an economic model right now where everyone is committed to infinite growth. And while I don't believe that's sustainable, that's the market we live in. And it is going to be hard going forward to, like, they're probably, you know, all of these big franchises that have been pumping out so much content, like the MCU, like Star Wars, like DC, you know, they're all going to start slowing down and spreading out because they have to. They have to, you know, and that also is going to mean everything's going to come back to theaters. You know, we're going to have a lot less streaming original movies and start putting things back out in theaters again because things don't make money at home. You know, if there's something that you really like and you want more of, seeing it in theaters is a big way to help get more of it. You know, the better it does in theaters or, you know, in some kind of sales and viewership numbers on streaming is the hardest thing right now because, first of all, no studio is going to ever release that information publicly. I think that's the one demand of the strike that's, it's just never going to happen. But it's no one knows what that means. No one knows really how that correlates to subscriber numbers. All they can really say is when releasing a new thing is a jump in new subscribers. That's the closest they can have with something making money and really tracking publicly. So it as far as like being a consumer and like trying to steer what you want more of, that's how you do it. You know, that's where anyone who is like, oh, there's no way these other Avatar movies are successful, it's like the amount of money Avatar 2 made, they are not slowing down on 3, 4, and 5 by any stretch of the imagination. But you know, these Marvel movies, whether they're good or not, doesn't matter. If they're not making the amount of money they need to make to justify their existence, they're going to slow down. They're going to get lower budgets, so on. You know, just like Rise of Skywalker, and part of it, it's a little too early to say to blame it on COVID, but it didn't make the amount of money it was expected to make. It had a big drop off from Last Jedi, and from it did better than Solo, but it was expected to do much better than Solo. And that's where, you know, on top of COVID. But that's where, yeah, the movies kind of dried up for a little bit because they had to kind of figure out how do we get back to what people are wanting.
Yeah. It's got to be such an interesting thing because we are, like, I'm curious, you meant, you know, where we are right now in streaming and things in the theater, how all of this is working clearly isn't working the way it needs to, but it can also never go back to where it was because now we have different expectations. So it's really interesting to see what's going to come out of this. And I do agree, like it all came, a lot has changed that maybe we're not seeing the same way because, like you said, it happened slowly, but as things start to disappear, things will oftentimes disappear faster than they got there to begin with. You know, so we'll notice a lot of that stuff going forward. And I'm really curious to see what Star Wars is going to do with that. You know, I'm not invested in much other things the same way I'm Star Wars, you know, but like I'm curious how things like Rogue One and Solo in particular would have done now. This whole idea of the Star Wars stories that just like because one didn't do great, like they put the kibosh on it, which was frustrating because personally I was excited, or they wanted to move it into the streaming shows or whatnot.
I think it's more than that, because it's also, you know, yeah, these one-off movies, both of them had such severe production issues. Mm-hmm. And then when you have that, and then it's like the amount of return on investment, and then the success of The Mandalorian, like I think they're all going to come back, but it's not going to be quite in the same way. I think, yep. Again, it just needed a regrouping of like, okay, what stories are we going to tell and how?
Yep.
I also think that the Skywalker saga, as it were, being over, it kind of forces us to go in new directions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, and I don't want to like bait controversies of different fandom stuff, but like I've always been a big fan of Rian Johnson. You know, I was hoping he did what would become Force Awakens. You know, I was like in the back of my mind. So that's where, you know, I think his idea of like a new trilogy and a new part of the timeline that hasn't been explored at all, that's going to be one of the best ideas for the franchise. I think the Acolyte being, you know, kind of the bridge between the High Republic and the prequels, that's going to be one of the best ideas. Opening up these other areas of the franchise is going to be so necessary to keeping it going. You know, there's a level by which I think a lot of Star Wars right now is playing a game of Snake. You know, I don't know if you remember the old cell phone game Snake, where it's like you start as like two dots, you grab the next dot, and like you keep getting longer, and if you run into yourself, you die. there's a big part of that going on right now as we are filling up every single minute between episode 1 and episode 9. We need to branch out. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with, you know, the Mandoverse corner of Star Wars. You know, I'm really excited to see more of what Dave is doing with the Ahsoka series and with the eventual film to kind of cap off that story. And knowing that story has an ending planned to some degree, that makes it more exciting to me. You know, I think endings can be really exciting. And that was maybe the thing that made Rise of Skywalker more disappointing, because it didn't really satisfy that sense of ending. But that's also why we're getting a Rey movie, to kind of help spin that off into a new idea and a new direction. But, and again, I can't emphasize enough the amount of people doing all these things, you know, and the amount of like, you always see the viral tweets of like, oh, they had another issue with a big creative or whatever, and, you know, and then like citing things where it was like something that was in development, like that hadn't had a script yet and hadn't started filming yet. And it's like, well, that's not actually the same thing. That's like, they were pitching, they were hoping it was going to go, and then for one reason or another, it didn't. That's not the same as like, you know, Lord and Miller were fired. Like that is indisputable. They were asked to leave the production and someone else came in and reshot the movie. And it's not the same as like reshoots is a normal part of the process. Every film has reshoots, no matter how buttoned up you think it is. There's always something you have to go back for, or something you weren't able to get in at the right time at the beginning. But because of a big profile example like Solo, we've now trained the culture to think, oh, reshoots means there's problems. It's like, no, that's not that's not what that means.
Also, when you're making anything of that size and with that much money, there's going to be problems along the way anyways, like no matter what, like nothing is going to go off without a hitch. And in creative spaces, like you said, I think when you brought up the Snake thing, I'm thinking like shedding its skin, which I also think Star Wars is kind of doing right now, and I really can't wait to see what comes out after, you know,
oh yeah,
what's going to come of all of this, because, and I'm telling you, that was a great interview. Thank you so much for listening and watching. We appreciate it. I appreciate it. This has been fantastic. I had such a great time. I don't have much more to add. So, you know, you can follow me in the show at Serving Pink Milk on Twitter, on Instagram. Join our Discord if you're interested in supporting the show. We're on Patreon too. All of those wonderful, wonderful things. And until next week, my friends, let's bring good.